Since President Trump has been in office, the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, has filed more than 100 lawsuits defending America's constitutional rights. The ACLU and its legal staff were first and fervent responders to President Trump's travel ban. The organization won its initial case against the ban, and as a result, the ACLU's profile soared. Their membership is the highest it's ever been in the organization's 97-year history. The donations have poured in by the millions, and people are eagerly looking to the ACLU for ways to be civically engaged. The current socio-political climate has given the nonprofit new life. In their search for new ways to have a more meaningful and lasting cultural and political footprint, they have been studying, rather unexpectedly, the strategy of the NRA. Joining us is reporter Mark Joseph Stern, who covers courts and law for Slate and has been chronicling the ACLU's recent developments. We are also joined by writer Joel Lovell, whose article, Can the ACLU Become the NRA for the Left?, featured in the New York Times Magazine, takes a close look at the ACLU's new NRA-inspired strategy. Mark and Joel, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So, Joel, I'll start with you. Unlike most entities, the ACLU didn't automatically discount Donald Trump becoming president. What did they do to start to prepare for the possibility of the Donald Trump presidency?
Yeah, so back in the summer of 2016, late July, when most of the rest of the country, I think, was assuming or trusting that Hillary Clinton was going to win fairly easily, Anthony Romero, who's the executive director of the ACLU, asked his attorneys on staff to draw up two reports, one a Clinton report, one a Trump report. And those reports were essentially looking at the constitutional threats that each of these candidates posed and drawing up a legal strategy to fight those threats.
Yeah, and one important detail I think that was in your reporting was that Romero was getting a lot of pushback from his staff in terms of going full bore with the Trump report, right? They wanted to focus on Clinton.
Yeah, totally. I mean, they're very busy people, as you'd imagine. And I think they were thinking, like, why are we going to spend a bunch of time on Trump? We can, we can more or less assume Clinton is going to win. So let's like button down our strategies there and not spend too much time worrying about Trump. And Anthony was very insistent. No. I mean, if Trump wins, we want to be ready out of the gate. And so, you know, what they did is they hired a firm to collect all of the statements that he made on the stump. And then they divided those statements into various categories. And then in each category, you know, women's rights and immigrants' rights and LGBT rights and so on. They said, okay, well, if he's going to be true to his promises here, then what's our strategy going to be for fighting him?
So soon after Trump won the 2016 election, what bold and unprecedented move did the ACLU make?
Yeah, so the morning after the election when, much of the country, I think, or at least a little more than half of the country anyway, was in shock and dismay. Again, Romero went into his office that first day. He pulled up that report that they had drawn up back in the summer. He read through it. He wrote up a full-page ad for the New York Times that then ran, I think, 2 days later, essentially saying, like, look, these are all the ways in which Donald Trump is a threat to the Constitution. And basically, we'll see you in court.
So this seems like this was the kickoff to their new direction that they were going.
Yeah, exactly. And from that moment on, a bunch of people started turning to the ACLU, sending money, joining as members, and it was that moment, and then combined a couple of months later with the Muslim ban, that really like sparked a nationwide kind of resurgence of the institution.
Right. Yeah. The letter definitely seemed to have made waves in some circles, but I think that reaction to the travel ban was something that might have reverberated wider. Talk to us about the ACLU's response to the travel ban initially.
So the very initial response was, you know, they expected that it was coming. And then they found out the day before the ban was actually issued, like, okay, we know that it's coming now in the next 24 hours. And they responded in three different ways. One was they had their own clients on behalf of whom they argue, like, look, this is an unconstitutional measure. And so we're gonna fight this in the courts. Then there was the more urgent issue of people who were coming in and being detained and trying to get all of the attorneys who are volunteering their services to be able to file habeas petitions on behalf of all those people who are being detained in airports all over the country. And the ACLU was pumping out essentially like a format for a habeas petition. Like, here it is, follow this format, file as many petitions as you can. And then the third thing was, in the immediate aftermath of the order, they they argued for and won a stay on the ban and an immediate injunction, which happened out in the federal district court in Brooklyn.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Joel Lavelle about his article for the New York Times Magazine, Can the ACLU Become the NRA for the Left? And we're going to be bringing Mark Joseph Stern into the conversation shortly, who reports for Slate on courts and law. Joel, I do want to find out from you, I want you to sort of quantify for our listeners the growth that the ACLU has experienced over the last 2 years in terms of membership, money.
Yeah, so prior to November of 2016, they had about 400,000 members, give or take, roughly around 400,000. As of a couple of months ago, that number is just shy of 2 million. It's about 1.9 million, I think, now. And then in terms of money, you know, if you look back the 3 or 4 years before Donald Trump's election, they would raise somewhere between $3 and $5 million. Since Trump's election, they've raised about $120 million. So a total sea change in terms of their operational budget.
So how are they using these newly acquired resources?
In lots of ways. I mean, what you'd imagine is they hired a bunch of lawyers, for one, because they were going to be filing a lot more suits. They knew that. When Trump was elected, they had about 300 lawyers nationwide. And the structure of the ACLU is that there's a national office, and then there's affiliates in every state in the country. And so in total, counting the national office and the affiliates, they had about 300 lawyers. Now they're up near 500 or on their way to about 500. So they hired a bunch of attorneys, but then they also created or bulked up what's called the peoplepower.org, they call it. It's a sort of activist wing of the ACLU, which, you know, they'd always had lobbyists, but now it's a much more sort of muscular part of the organization.
And I think it's important to underscore, too, that growth from 300 lawyers to 500, which is their goal, is substantial. But in your reporting, we find out that is a drop in the bucket compared to the lawyer force that the Justice Department has, yes?
Totally. It's like a BB against a battleship. I mean, the DOJ has 11,000 attorneys who work for them. And then you add in Homeland Security and the Department of Education and Health and Human Services, all of these other fronts on which the ACLU fights. And there are around 18 or 19,000 government lawyers. So it's still a staggering difference.
So what is the current structure of the ACLU, and how does the ACLU operate on a national level, and how does it function on a state level? We can bring Mark into this as well.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, they've got a national office, and they're filing suits, they're filing FOIA requests, doing all the things that you imagine constitutional lawyers do. And then each state has its own affiliate. And they're fighting more on the ground in those states. So, for instance, in Texas right now, there's something called the SB4 law in Texas, which requires local law enforcement officials to cooperate with Border Patrol and with ICE and help them locate and apprehend undocumented immigrants. And so the state affiliate in Texas is fighting that with the help of the national office, and that happens all over the country.
So, Mark, I want to bring you into the conversation because, you know, beyond sort of big splashy letters in the New York Times, it seems like the ACLU has really focused in on specific issues in specific states and communities. So to that end, what proceedings occurred between the ACLU of New Hampshire and the U.S. Customs and Border Protection? I know you've been covering that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so there's an ongoing saga in New Hampshire because the entire state is within something called the border zone. And under U.S. law, the Customs and Border Protection Agency is able to operate anywhere within 100 miles of the border. And that includes the entire state as well as a huge chunk of the country. And so starting shortly after Trump took office, CBP started setting up these checkpoints in New Hampshire designed in part to find individuals who are here without proper authorization, but also to find individuals who may have committed low-level drug offenses. And what CBP ended up doing was teaming up with local police in New Hampshire and turning over everyone who had, say, a few grams of marijuana in their car to the local police and then allowing local authorities to prosecute them. This was a problem because New Hampshire law is actually much more protective of an individual's privacy in his or her car than federal constitutional law. And so what New Hampshire police were basically doing was using CBP's broad federal authority authority to work around the tight restrictions on searches and seizures under state law. The ACLU rounded up dozens of individuals who had been caught in this dragnet, went to court to suppress all of the evidence that was gathered against them, almost entirely a small amount of marijuana, and succeeded in getting that evidence suppressed. This was obviously not an earthquake, but it was a pretty big victory over a federal agency that almost always wins in court, and it was a great example, I think, of the ACLU affiliates focusing on a very local issue and protecting the rights of state residents by taking officials to court.
Yeah, and as you describe that process, I mean, the first thing that occurs to me is it's so much work out of the gate, even just connecting with the individuals who have been affected by the Border Patrol activity and getting them all on the same page in terms of approaching the court. Who's Scott Lloyd, and why has the ACLU sued the Office of Refugee Resettlement?
So Scott Lloyd is the director of that office, of ORR, and he is a very, very anti-abortion attorney who has no actual expertise in protecting refugee children, which is the main task of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Traditionally, this has been an agency that oversees the housing of undocumented immigrant minors who are here without their parents, typically who have arrived in this country unaccompanied by any family member. So when Scott Lloyd took over the agency, he effectively turned it into a kind of anti-abortion machine and began to implement these rather draconian restrictions on pregnant, undocumented minors who are under ORR's care. He issued this guidance that effectively prohibited all of these minors from accessing abortion and instead forced them to go to crisis pregnancy centers where they would be counseled out of terminating their pregnancies. This is unconstitutional under longstanding Supreme Court precedent. And so the ACLU sued Scott Lloyd on behalf of one of these minors, Jane Doe, a 17-year-old, and won in a very high-profile battle here in D.C. at the D.C. Circuit Court. Jane Doe got her abortion the day after, and then Scott Lloyd and the Justice Department asked the U.S. Supreme Court to actually sanction the ACLU attorneys who had helped Jane Doe to issue a formal punishment against them because of their zealous advocacy. The Supreme Court turned down that request, but it was a rather startling example of federal vindictiveness against the attorneys who are frequently challenging them in court.
How out of bounds is that request of the High Court to sanction them? I mean, is that something that happens with frequency? That seems like an outlier.
No, not at all frequent. It was an extremely unusual move. It was shocking at the time. It remains shocking. And notably, career attorneys at the Justice Department, nonpartisan civil servants who work there through Republican and Democratic administrations, strongly opposed it, refused to sign on to the request, and apparently worked behind the scenes to quash it. But they did not succeed, and Trump's political appointees moved forward with it. It was really, as I said, quite shocking. And it drew kind of bipartisan scorn. Really, they were simply asking ACLU lawyers to be punished for being good at their jobs, and that is not traditionally something that the DOJ has done, even when it loses badly.
Mark and Joel, both of you, I mean, in your reporting, and Joel, first to you, do you feel like the judges that have sort of overseen many of these cases that we've discussed and will discuss are picking sides, or do you have a sense that sort of justice is playing out, due process is playing out as we'd like it to?
You know, I think it varies case by case.
Yeah.
In some of the big cases, for instance, the huge family separation case, that was heard recently in the Southern District in California. The judge who heard that is a George W. Bush appointee, overwhelmingly a conservative judge, I think everybody would agree. And he heard that case and really strongly ruled against the government. So you know, the hope is that those kind of judges will hold the line for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the first federal judge to issue a nationwide injunction blocking Donald Trump's very first travel ban way back after he first took office, that judge was also a George W. Bush appointee.
Right.
And so it's not as if this is just a kind of judicial resistance to Trump, as some conservative commentators have put it. It's much more than that. There are judges across the ideological spectrum coming together and ruling in favor of the ACLU when they believe the executive branch has really stepped far out of bounds.
And one quick question, Joel. How did the ACLU find out about the travel ban the night before it became public information?
Well, they had a general sense from signals coming from the White House that that this executive order was going to come out. The question was just when. And then, you know, I'm not exactly sure, but I think, somehow they got a draft order within 24 to 48 hours before it actually came out. I'm not positive who it came from.
I'm D.W. Gibson, speaking with Joel Lavelle and Mark Stern about the reporting on the ACLU. Joel, I want to talk about past perceptions of the ACLU. Talk to us about how the sort of ACLU functioned pre-Donald Trump and what sort of the national perspective was on them.
Yeah, I think for people who don't follow closely the work of the ACLU, there was a kind of broad, somewhat cartoonish sense of who they are, informed by a couple of things. Maybe the first thing that would come to people's mind is George H.W. Bush and Michael Dukakis in a debate during their campaigns, and George Bush turning to Dukakis and calling him a card-carrying member of the ACLU, suggesting he was an anti-government communist, basically.
Right.
So that's one perception. The other is that they're sort of free speech purists. People who don't know a lot about the ACLU might know about the defense of the Nazi rally in Skokie back in 1978. That they'll defend free speech no matter how offensive the speech might be. And then the last thing is just that, sort of broadly, there are a bunch of lefty lawyers kind of running their litigation, suing the government. They opposed Richard Nixon. They're kind of a left-leaning collective group of attorneys.
Right. So why do they, in-house, the idea is that they are staunchly nonpartisan, right? So this stands in direct contrast to much of what you just described. Talk to me a little bit about that disconnect, and is the new direction that they're going in looking to be still as nonpartisan?
Yeah, I mean, in-house, their sense of themselves is not that they're I mean, they don't even think, I think, in terms of left and right, really. They think of themselves as several people said to me over the course of my reporting, the only thing we're partisan about is the Bill of Rights. That's the only thing we really care about. And we'll defend, as powerfully as we can. What's happening now with Trump, though, is that you have an administration that is so offensive to the Constitution that it's hard not to think of them as being politically resistant to him, although what they're doing is what they've always done, which is defend the Constitution. The thing that they're now doing, though, additionally, is playing a much more sort of muscular role in terms of political activism. I think they're getting into the activism world in a much more aggressive way than they have in the past.
So with that in mind, how did the NRA's strategy get on the ACLU's radar?
So this goes back, it predates Trump, really. Back in 2013, Anthony Romero, who's been the executive director since just before September 11th, 2001, is when he took over. Anthony was thinking about where and how the institution can grow, and really just how they can be more effective other than running their cases in the world of litigation. And he thought, well, who's the most effective civil society organization in America? And the answer is the NRA. They're incredibly effective at what they do. And so he hired a consulting firm to essentially analyze what makes the NRA so effective. And the results, the answers that he got were different than what many of us think. When we sort of assume, oh, it's because they pour a bunch of money into campaigns, they threaten not to pour money into campaigns. It's really about the NRA's power of the purse. And what he found out is that, in fact, their strength comes much more from their ability to activate this membership, to say, like, okay, there's a threat over here. We're going to send the bat signal out. And what's going to happen is our members are going to flood offices with phone calls. They're going to march in front of representatives' offices. They're going to cause a lot of headaches for people that they oppose.
Yeah, at one point in your reporting, the thing that really stands out is the NRA's capacity not to necessarily write a check or not write a check, but to say, we have 8,000 members who live in your district, and you're going to receive letters from all of them, and actually receive letters from all of them, or visits, or angry calls, or whatever that case may be.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're a very, very active membership. And so even in a district that might have, 60,000 people, if a few thousand of those people are NRA members and they are the most vocal and active members of the district, they're going to get results.
So what NRA strategies is the ACLU going to employ to activate their membership in such a fashion?
Well, so the real question then is, like, how do you create a community of people who just passionately believes in the same things that you believe in and are willing to make the phone calls, write the checks for sure, but, come to the marches, go to the town halls, do all the things that get representatives to pay attention to them. And so, what the ACLU is trying to do is to say, if you hold civil liberties dear, if you care about voting rights, if you care about immigrants' rights, if you care about the rights of women, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then now is a time when you have to fight for them, because those things are really, really endangered. And that is sort of a direct corollary to this thing that leaders in the NRA talk about, which is that what the NRA has is what they call the threat. Our members believe that somebody is coming to take their guns away. And if they believe that, then they're going to fight tooth and nail in order to protect what they believe is their right to have their guns. And so the ACLU is just trying to create their version of that.
And what is their threat? What is the threat for the ACLU?
I mean, the threat, which we're now seeing every day, right? I mean, when Trump was first elected, before he took office, I think a lot of us were thinking, like, well, maybe he won't really do all these things he said he's going to do. He might be bad, but he's not going to be nightmarishly bad. And I think what we're finding now is, in terms of civil liberties, he is, in fact, nightmarishly bad. And so if you care about any of those things, like, this is the moment when you have to fight to preserve them, because they really aren't a threat.
And there does seem to be a really central challenge that's spelled out in your article, that the NRA has something very tangible, right? Guns, yeah. And a proud gun owner who looks at that as sort of their lifestyle, their safety, can see that item and have literally cling to it and have something that they're protecting. There's a challenge with the ACLU in protecting the Bill of Rights. There's not that tangible item. It can't be sort of made so apparent and simple and in front of your eyes.
Right. It is difficult because it's more abstract. But what the NRA does is it's not just the gun. It's really the sense that those members have of their own lifestyles, their own values. Yes, they have guns. Yes, they care about the Second Amendment. But really, that's just a symbol for everything that they think about America, really, their place in America, what's important to them. So if their guns are under threat, their whole sense of who they are is under threat. And so that's the thing that I think the ACLU is really trying to amp up, which is, if you care about these rights, they are under threat. And it isn't just, oh, those immigrants are endangered, or, oh, some voting rights are endangered. It really is a whole sense of, like, what you believe America is and how your own sense of yourself connects to that.
I'm D.W. Gibson, speaking with Joel Lavelle and Mark Stern about the reporting on the ACLU. Mark, how is the ACLU creating a single mission out of many pressing issues? I know you've been in the weeds on how they're functioning in different states. How are they creating a single mission out of all of these different issues?
Yeah, so today the overarching goal is to oppose Trump's anti-civil rights, civil liberties agenda. And as we've heard, that's a very effective rallying cry, because all of a sudden there is sort of one man at the top of the government who seems to represent and even personify all of the stuff that the ACLU opposes: attacks on freedom of speech, freedom of the press, LGBTQ equality, women's reproductive rights. And so it's pretty easy for the ACLU to rally its base against Trump on the national level. But you also see on the state level, of course, within these affiliates, focus on these local issues that are very, very important to voters within these states. And so another example is in North Carolina. The North Carolina ACLU has not had a wink of sleep in years, because the legislature is overwhelmingly Republican, due, in fact, to a racial gerrymander that the Supreme Court has ruled unconstitutional, and the legislature has passed just a series of bills that are clearly designed to disenfranchise minorities in the state. And so the new North Carolina ACLU has just had to rally its troops constantly. It feels like every few months it's calling on its members to lobby the legislature, to march in the streets, to help donate funds, to prevent this rollback of the franchise in North Carolina. The state has really become ground zero in the war on voting rights. And so that is an issue that speaks to individuals, civil libertarians, and progressives on the ground in that state. Similarly, in Texas, the fight over SB4, the so-called anti-sanctuary cities law, has sort of been the focal point of the Texas ACLU's organizing, as well as the perennial issue of opposition to abortion, of endless streams of anti-abortion laws coming from the legislature and from the governor. And so in every state, there is some kind of overarching threat to civil liberties that the ACLU has decided to devote its efforts to. In Montana, there was a threat of an anti-transgender ballot initiative that the ACLU effectively fought back. And so again, they have this national mission. They recognize that they can get a lot of money and a lot of support by opposing Trump. But they're not losing sight of those local issues, and they're keeping those states, which are, of course, our laboratories of democracy, they're keeping them from backsliding into Trumpist territory and trying to maintain their support on the local and grassroots level the same way that the NRA very effectively has.
Well, and by dialing down on a very local issues, as you've just enumerated for us in several cases, it makes the threat very real, right? It keeps it out of this sort of abstract realm that we've been discussing and makes it practical.
That's exactly right. And people may not see how Donald Trump's actions are going to personally affect them every single day. But when they see the legislature passing a law like SB4, which in addition to outlawing sanctuary cities in Texas, criminalized speech in favor of sanctuary cities by public officials, people recognize, hey, this is hitting close to home. If my city council member says, I support sanctuary cities, the Texas police can come and arrest him and fine him $25,000. That was an actual provision of that law. Now, the ACLU fought back against the law with mixed success. The Fifth Circuit did uphold much of it, but even this very, very conservative panel of judges ruled in favor of the ACLU on this provision of SB4, the gag rule that barred public officials from supporting sanctuary cities. So even where the ACLU does not score an unqualified win, it can still get these concessions or win on the margins and make the law a little less toxic than it was in the first place. And its supporters absolutely appreciate those gains, whether they're big or small.
Joel, with the 2018 midterm elections on the horizon, what is the ACLU's strategy for impacting legislation?
So they made a very conscious decision that in these upcoming elections and in some of the other elections in the last several months, that they were going to get involved wherever it felt like their core issues were at stake. They absolutely were not going to endorse or oppose individual candidates. They weren't going to throw any money into individual races. But if there was a civil liberties or civil rights issue at stake, they were going to let voters know what that issue was and what all of where all the candidates stood on that issue. And so they're doing that now.
They have a scorecard system, right?
Yeah, the score, which is a classic NRA maneuver, right? Like here where the candidates stand on the Second Amendment. They did this. They used the scorecard system recently in a state Supreme Court race in Wisconsin. They basically called up the various candidates and said, where do you stand on LGBT issues? Where do you stand on voting rights? Where do you stand on access to abortion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They then made up a scorecard. They sent out hundreds of thousands of them to voters. The candidate who won was the one who I think they would say absolutely was the one who was most friendly to their notion of civil liberties. And so now they're doing this in various races across the country.
And what is peoplepower.org?
So PeoplePower is a platform that they built shortly after Trump became president. They launched it in March of 2017. And it essentially was a way to activate their members to say, you can come here and you can figure out, is there something going on in my area that I can join in on? Is there a march? Is there some kind of protest? Is there a town hall? this will be the sort of the clearinghouse for all this information. If you want to start something, if you want to meet with other members in your area, here's where you can organize that. It was basically like an organizing platform.
Mark, do you have a sense of whether or not about the sort of efficacy of that program being on the ground and reporting?
Well, the scorecard is absolutely a classic NRA maneuver, and I think it will help clarify for ACLU supporters where certain candidates stand. I think that the ACLU's intervention is going to help a lot in primaries. It may already have, because, you know, even though the ACLU is absolutely nonpartisan and definitely within the ranks, you will not hear biased support for the Democratic Party over Republicans. It just so happens that currently the Democratic Party favors most of the issues that the ACLU cares most about. Not all of them. There are certainly some areas where the ACLU takes Democrats to task. But they're mostly working within the Democratic Party to try to pull it toward civil liberties on many issues, and also to try to help the most left candidate get a lot of support and grassroots support and media coverage and all of that. And so I think so far we've seen the ACLU contribute in a lot of subtle ways to the resurgence of the American left and electoral politics. And I think that if there are individuals who maybe were moderate centrist or even moderate Republican voters who sometimes flipped in between, Republican sometimes, Democrat sometimes, but they hate Trump and they love what the ACLU has done to oppose Trump, they will be absolutely clued in the general election to the fact that, hey, Trump really represents the Republican Party today, and the Republican Party represents everything that the ACLU opposes. So even if the Democrats aren't perfect, this candidate, who happens to be a Democrat, is much stronger on civil liberties than her Republican opponent. So you should consider looking into her and not just going down a kind of centrist, moderate Republican party line vote this year.
Joel, you quote the national political director of the ACLU as saying, "It will be easier for Trump to hurt the people he promised to hurt than to help the people he promised to help." Is this the real reason the ACLU has become necessary now more than ever, you think?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, they're just, again, all you have to do is open your eyes and look at the news on any morning, and you see some group who's under very real threat. And so Faz Shakir, who you just mentioned, the national political director, you know, he said, and I think rightly, look, unless you're an extraordinary rich person who's going to get great tax breaks, or you're a corporation looking to not have to abide by regulatory rules anymore, there's pretty much nobody who's going to be helped by Trump's policies, but many, many, many people who are going to be hurt. And from his perspective, that's like a great rallying cry, right? A lot of us are going to be hurt. A lot of the people you care about are going to be hurt. So now is the time to come out and fight.
It's really important context for the upcoming election in which we should all be voting. I'm very grateful to you, Joel, and to Mark for joining me today. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much
for having me on. I'm D.W. Gibson, and I've been speaking with journalists Joel Lavelle and Mark Stern about their reporting on the ACLU's evolving role in politics.